Broadcasting from Manhattan Beach and the World Wide Web, you're listening to CHSR, HealthyLife.net.
As a service to our listeners, this program is for general information and entertainment purposes only. CHSRHealthyLife.net does not recommend, endorse, or object to the views, products, or topics expressed or discussed by show hosts or their guests. We suggest you always consult with your own personal, medical, financial, or legal advisor.
Welcome. You're listening to Way of the Dreamer with Robert Noss. This is where we affirm and celebrate the power of dreams, coincidence, and imagination in our lives. We have a wonderful guest today. Her name is Deirdre Barrett. We were just talking about what Yeats made of that name in his play, Deirdre. She is a leading dream researcher, president of the International Association for the Study of Dreams, editor of its very worthwhile journal, Dreaming. She's written 5 books. At least, including one on creative dreaming called The Committee of Sleep, and one on the effects of COVID on our dream lives called Pandemic Dreams, I believe. I've known her for a long time, I think since I went to my first ASD conference in Santa Fe in 1993, certainly since the conference in Leiden in 1994. And one of the things we're going to talk to about today is how dreams can be a source and a fund of creative inspiration and guidance, and how we might set ourselves up in our lives to do more of that kind of creative dreaming. Welcome, Deirdre.
Hi, it's great to be here.
It's good to have you. Yes, I was looking, I love Yeats. In fact, I'm writing a chapter about Yeats in a new book of my own, and since you're on today, I looked at Yeats as Deirdre. He makes of her something different from the traditional Irish legend. He has her born in a house in the woods, nursed by a witch, and it's unclear in his version whether she's goddess, human, or something else altogether. So it's certainly a name to conjure with. So one of the things I'd love to talk to you about is, first of all, let's be topical. You've written literally the book on COVID dreaming. Talk to us about how the pandemic has, by your observation, changed how people dream, and perhaps especially how they're ready to share and value dreams. What effect has that had on the broader society, would you say?
I think at least for a while, there were so many chat boards that where people were sharing their dreams about COVID or the pandemic more broadly. I collected thousands off a website I had specifically set up, but I also looked at some of these things that were happening spontaneously. And one thing that my survey was not set up to look at, but that I noted on the other chat boards, was that many people were saying they were remembering more dreams than usual. And I think something that was unique about COVID was any other crisis, like I collected dreams after 9/11, and some other disasters, that any other crisis tends to get people anxious, potentially disrupt their sleep because of that, but then also cut their sleep short because they're doing all kinds of things to take care of the crisis, or they're watching more news and they still have to go to work and take care of their kids and all the usual things. But with COVID, it's the only crisis where we were told to stay home and lie on our couches and watch more Netflix, essentially, right, as the solution. So people were reporting worse sleep in the sense of waking up more often, but they were reporting more hours of sleep. So that's that more awakenings and yet more total is very conducive to dream recall. So people caught up on sleep and got, like, the amount of dream recall that nature intended for the first time. And so aside from the main thing that I studied, which was the dreams really about COVID, it was also just a time that people became more aware of dreams.
You use the phrase nature intended, which makes me smile with appreciation because, of course, as you know, I've always been a polyphasic sleeper like our ancestors were. I mean, people didn't expect to go to bed and sleep for 6, 7, 8, 9 hours without waking up. They expected actually to sleep and dream in different cycles. This is the way that humans have related to sleep and dreams for most of our time on the planet. It's only with, you know, artificial lighting and so on and the plenitude of it that things have changed. So in a sense, we might say that people were thrust by conditions back into something like the old polyphasic, you know, sleep-wake-dream cycle. And another thing we might say is that absent the possibility of traveling and getting around the way that we were used to doing, people began to discover that they can travel from home without leaving home. They can travel in their dreams, and that might be interesting. And so that might be something that came into play as well, and they could keep in touch with people they couldn't see in ordinary reality. They could go and have dinner with someone in Paris, even if they were living in Boston, and they could do that in their dreams. So maybe all of that began to play in. And, of course, you know, people were watching more Netflix. I certainly started watching more streaming TV than I thought I would ever make time for in the course of COVID. But then I also noticed that they have an interior, you know, movie track, don't they? They have an interior streaming track. So what else would you say to us? I mean, that was a very helpful introduction. What else would you say to us about the social effects of, and perhaps the psychological effects of COVID? Did it change the content of dreaming amongst the samplings that you looked at?
Well, I mean, I don't know that any of these, including the dream recall, are at all permanent effects, but it certainly changed it during the time. And a lot of it was, I think the dream sharing was great, but a lot of what it did to our dreams was negative. In analyzing the dreams that came into my survey, there was 3 times the amount of fear and anxiety in dreams for both men and women. Specifically, death content went up even more. So people were scared and dreaming overtly about dying or just about more metaphoric anxieties. And then interestingly, that was pretty true for both genders, but women had a lot more of other negative dreams that were angry or sad. And men did not shoot up on those 2 dimensions, which I think when I kind of looked into what could be causing that, it seemed to map on to some waking facts that women were doing more of the day-to-day nursing care of sick relatives if they were at home, or women tend to have the sort of harder, more direct hands-on nursing jobs in the medical profession, and also had worse access to the protective equipment than did male physicians during the pandemic. Women lost their jobs, were fired in larger numbers during the pandemic than men because they had less job security written into contracts in the first place. So I think that we saw women getting upset in all kinds of different negative ways in what came out in their dreams, whereas for men it was just the sheer fear.
Right. And then I don't know to what extent you're able to track the follow-up from individual dreams, dreams of anxiety, dreams of distress, etc. But the question in my mind is whether people, through the dreams that were fearful dreams, were getting practical advisories that they could act upon. In other words, you see something you don't like. Is it a useful reminder to take some precaution, avoid a certain space or something like that? Did you notice anything of that kind of people finding more practical application for dreams that might in themselves be disturbing but might contain, you know, an actionable warning?
I certainly saw individual, anecdotally, I saw that. I wasn't set up to really score for that, but I'd also say it wasn't common that people, I was asking for the dreams rather than for the, what they did with them. But there were certainly some dramatic anecdotes of that. One of them was from your old neck of the woods, a woman in Australia. She actually said that she lived around the Bondi Beach scene, and that since COVID had come along and the lockdown had started there, that her crowd had been totally ignoring it and holding big parties and just laughing off the idea that, COVID was a threat. And then she had a dream that she was throwing a party, and they had to do, even in waking life, they had to do this sort of surreptitiously because there was a lockdown order. So she was like texting friends that there was going to be this party, you know, with no decorations or signage or anything at her house at a certain time, and getting huge numbers of people to agree they were coming to this party. And then she dreamed the party starting, and it was kind of wild and fun, like she experienced things. And then the state security broke in through her windows to stop the party. And they simply said what in waking life she'd heard before, that this was very dangerous and that multiple people were going to catch COVID, which some people were dying of, even some young people like her crowd, and that everyone was to leave immediately. And in the dream, she felt horrible that she'd created this situation, and the fact that the state security had been sent to her house to break this up made her realize that she'd been doing a really bad thing. And she woke up from the dream feeling guilty and ashamed and frightened for safety over what she'd been just completely blasé about, awake. And she remarked that she did completely change her attitude toward the orders about social distancing and mask wearing and no
large
gathering.
That's a great story. Yes. I remember Bondi Beach as a kid. It's hard to shut down the party scene around that beach in any period, any generational history. So a dream that got
I've
through,
only
I
been
guess,
there for one afternoon, but I still have the picture.
Well, it's also nice to hear, you know, a dream that is having that effect, that helpful effect. In a country with the oldest tradition of dreaming on the planet, of course, and although we might say that most of the first peoples of Australia, because of all that's happened, don't necessarily dream the way they used to. When you get out to West Australia around the Kookajar or people like that, you find that they're always looking for, you know, how a dream is actionable in terms of recognizing people and what they might be doing and what they might be going to do. So there's always a sort of primal detective aspect to their dream work. Who, what, where, when could this happen? Could ACO, the security outfit, actually break in and make a warning like that? A good example. All right, COVID is sort of behind us, so people are still getting it and people still need to be cautious about things. But let's move to a very cheerful and creative aspect of dreaming that you've written about and given us guidance on. You wrote a marvelous book called The Committee of Sleep, basically about the role of dreaming and innovation and creativity in many fields across history. I think the phrase is John Steinbeck's, isn't it? The Committee of Sleep. Talk to us in a general way to start off about why dreaming might be a secret laboratory, as Wolfgang Pauli said, for creative and inventive stuff, and how we can begin to tap into that.
Well, my conceptualization of what dreams are, and there are probably as many of these as there are dream psychologists, but I think of the, especially when I'm always getting asked about the purpose of dreams, and a lot of theorists have the purpose of dreams is memory consolidation, the purpose of dreams is threat simulation. Freud said the purpose of dreams was wish fulfillment. And the threat and wish are pretty much opposites. But I think it's kind of like asking what waking thought is for. It's for everything. So I believe that dreams, we are basically still concerned with all the same things that we are awake, our wishes, our fears, our personal lives, our professional lives, that all of those things we think about by day continue, but in this state that is much more visual and less verbal, it's much more intuitive and less linear logic. And so I think that especially problems that we're stuck on by day are likely to make breakthroughs in dreams just because the mode of thought is so different. It's not better. You'd be pretty bad off if you never had your waking faculties operating for you. But it's just different. So when our daytime patterns are not working for us, our dreams take a really different approach and can make breakthroughs. And while I think that even more of it is probably about our personal, social, emotional issues, that's what most dream psychologists have written the most about. So I've especially focused on the practical problem solving, the objective, the professional, the creative things that can come to us in our dreams. And one thing,
right,
when we were talking
about broad brush introduction, I was something popped up over the weekend, which you probably remember. You may have been editor of Dreaming at the time. An article that our friend Stan Krippner put together back in 1996, and he took 10 aspects of dreaming and compared what a Freudian, a Jungian, or someone following Ullman's dreamwork approach are looking in dreams. He compared that to what 16 Native American cultures look for in dreams. And he's going through, you know, 10 questions or 10 themes, like what is the source of dreams, or what's the purpose of dreams, etc. And the comparison is absolutely fascinating, and you know the general lines of the comparison, and most of us who've done any reading and had any brushes with indigenous cultures will know. While Freud says such and such, and Jung says such and such, and Ullman says such and such, when you ask, you know, the Kwakiutl, we look at Stan's looking at archival material principally, Franz Boas or the Kwakiutl, for example, or even at me for the Iroquois. You look at what these different indigenous traditions say. They say that we go to dreams in order to be in contact with the spirit world. We go to dreams to have contact with a hidden reality, which is at least as real and maybe more real than the surface world. We travel in dreams, or beings from the dream world travel to us. Well, whether we buy into that or not, I mean, the common thread here is the dreams give us access to sources and make connections beyond the ones that we routinely manage by ourselves, whether we call it the collective unconscious or the spirit world or something else. They do take us below and beyond the surface of events. And, you know, I find the connective, the agglutinative aspect of dreams very interesting, in the sense that they can bring together, you know, things that the ordinary mind doesn't seem even to be related. They can link things up and make creative combinations that defeat our ordinary sense of how things need to be in boxes. That's why Wolfgang Pauli, quantum physicist, friend of Jung's, you know, co-creator of the synchronicity theory, That's why Ali announced that dreams were his secret laboratory, because he found, often in that half-dream state between sleep and awake, that connections were made that eluded the ordinary mind. And I find that myself. I've never asked you this question, Deirdre. I don't know whether you've written about it or whether it's one of your favorite habitats. But what can you say to us about the state of hypnagogia? And do you spend much time there? And is this a particular creative playground?
I actually wrote about that some in the Committee of Sleep book, that while more than half the creative problem-solving dreams that I tell the stories of in that book look more like they are likely coming from REM sleep, they weren't in labs, of course, but they deeper into the night, kind of long story-like narratives, as well as vivid visual imagery, that's the kind of dream I'm talking about the most and recounting the most creative problem-solving issues from. But there definitely are a number of examples that are clearly from hypnagogic sleep onset state, which some people use the term dreams for, but they are distinctively different in that they're shorter, it's often a flow, sometimes it's kind of video-like, but often it's a flow of still images, tends to have less of a plot, but is at least as vivid visually as other dreams. And that's, for example, the state in which Kekule's benzene ring visualization of atoms dancing around and forming chains like snakes, and then one snake grabbing its tail in its mouth.
and him waking up realizing that the benzene structure which he'd been stuck on was a closed ring when all previously known molecules were some kind of straight line. It seems like when vivid visualization is the most important piece, that often it's this sleep onset. Visual artists get a lot of their inspiration. They will say they have just dozed off. Whereas things that are more complex, conceptually, the novelists who get their plot from dreams, that's generally in the deeper into the night, probably REM dreams. But visual artists get a lot from that sleep onset. And the scientists where it's seeing a structure specifically often credit their hypnagogic.
I find this half-dream state, which is the phrase I like to use for it, I like to call it the twilight zone, I like to call it the liminal state, I like to call it the half-dream state. I find it often the most interesting part of my night or day in terms of what happens in consciousness. I guess I've always been there a great deal because of my strange childhood. I have nights, Deirdre, when it seems that I'm in the half-dream state all night long, all the time I'm in bed anyway. And practice a certain kind of effortless bilocation, aware of my body in the bed while also being somewhere else or maybe in more than one other place. And I would say that for me the most important conversations of my life, I won't even classify them necessarily as spiritual, most important revelatory conversations of my life have taken place in this state. All right, we have to pause for a break. We're talking to the wonderful Deirdre Barrett, whose books on dreaming will interest you, the Committee of Sleep, Pandemic Dreams, president of the International Association Study of Dreams, teaches courses at Harvard, and has taught at other remarkable places too. We're back in a moment to talk about creative incubation, how you can put yourself into a place of creative breakthrough and inspiration through dreaming. Back after the break.
Where can you find out about dreams and the dream world? MossDreams.com. At MossDreams.com, you can find out about Robert Moss, his work, and discover the way of the dreamer. Read numerous articles and essays on almost every facet of dreams. Find out Robert's class and workshop schedule. Read reviews and so much more. Visit MossDreams.com to find your way of the dreamer. That's MossDreams.com.
Robert Moss has a deep engagement with the dream world, and now you can take a crash course from this master of active dreaming at your own pace. That's right. You can get Robert's 8 exciting half-hour programs on a new DVD set called Way of the Dreamer. Share Robert's story as a dreamer and dream healer. This dynamic 3 DVD set can help teach you how to find your way through your dreams to realize your full potential. Don't wait to learn the practical dreamwork techniques that can help you understand how to attain better health, emotional stability, spiritual awareness, and more. Order Way of the Dreamer DVDs today from Amazon.com or MossDreams.com. That's MossDreams.com.
We're HealthyLife.net, reaching and helping a worldwide audience without hype, without shock, and without shenanigans.
You're listening to Way of the Dream with Robert Moss. Do hop over to my website, mossdreams.com. I'm teaching a bunch of online courses and trainings, and there are some other goodies there, and I now have a Substack account if you're into that. We're talking to the wonderful Deirdre Barrett about dream incubation, dream creativity, and recently about what goes on in that drifty in-between state, which isn't written about enough from my point of view. In the literature. All right, Deirdre, people are now interested. They want to know how they can get a creative download from their dreams. We know that throughout history there have been many ways, some complex and some very expensive and some very elaborate. complex ways of approaching dream incubation, perhaps as temple sleep, where you have to pay off the priests and make offerings to the deities. But in the context of our modern lives, how would you advise someone who feels a need for guidance and help in relation to a certain life theme to look for that in their dreams, to approach dream incubation on an every night basis?
Well, Western psychologists have kind of borrowed the term dream incubation from, it's the Greeks term, but a number of ancient societies around the world had procedures and often places like temples one would go to sleep, Thailand, China, many places besides Greece had that. But in Greece they were called the incubation temples. And so we occasionally have people sleep together. I had a sleepover at the Rubin Museum of Art that was just fantastic to have 200 people in the museum incubating dream topics. But most of the time, we skip the physical part of going to a place, but do most of what the ancients did in asking our dreaming mind to focus on a particular topic. And it can be just a content, a wish, like seeing someone you haven't been with in physical reality, a girlfriend across the ocean, or something that you want to see in your dream, or you like flying dreams and you want to have one tonight. But it can also be a question that you focus on, an open-ended question, or it can be a problem that you're looking for a solution to, as specific as what is the structure of benzene. I know the atoms that make it up, but I don't know how they're put together because I'm living in the age before we had electron microscopes that could show me. So you have a problem, question, topic. You want to put it together as a very short phrase because our dreams have a little bit of verbal content and attention, but not as much as our waking self. So a really simple phrase or question. And then at least as important to visualize something that represents your topic, question, or problem. For most people, where seeing something in your mind's eye is a meaningful phrase, they should visualize something that goes with the problem because visual images get into our dreams much more naturally to the state of consciousness than the verbal part. However, there are a few people whose imagery, when you say, see something in your mind's eye, they don't really understand what other people mean by that. You know, they may know that their friend has black hair and blue eyes, but they can't really see them in an internal way. So if you're not a waking visualizer, then you want to put something on your nightstand that visually represents your problem or question. Sometimes a photo will do or an assemblage of objects. But anyway, have something, have your phrase, have your visual stimulus, which can usually be internal imagery, and focus on the phrase for a minute or two, then focus on the image. Then tell yourself, I want to dream about this tonight. Please let me have a dream about this tonight. And depending on your belief system, you can phrase that just as to your own unconscious, your dreaming mind, or to any deity or realm that you believe dreams go with. And just focus on, I want to dream about this, and your image as you're drifting off to sleep. And that makes it much more likely that you will dream on that topic that night. A lot of the examples in the Committee of Sleep happen spontaneously, but you have a much higher rate of dreaming a solution to a problem if you're trying to. I did one study with college students where for 1 week of doing that practice at bedtime on an objective problem, some were homework problems, some were just other things in their life, but that were not subjective, were things where when you dreamed a correct answer, everybody would agree that that was the answer to a given problem. So in a week of doing that, 50% of them dreamed on the topic of the problem, And then one-fourth of them dreamed solutions to their problem. And that is higher than in, I've done other studies, and Marty Schatzman and William Dement did studies, but the other studies tend to use things like brain teasers, which are kind of good because they puzzle people at first, and yet there is one correct answer. And so you can standardize what the question is going to be for everyone. But some people love brain teasers, but other people just find them annoying or silly or just a way to feel stupid. So I used people's real personal problems, but also they were things that they needed to work on in their real life. So they probably would have eventually solved them awake. So they were easy compared to what some brain teasers are. So I think that combination of strong innate motivation to solve this, but also, even though you haven't done it yet, it's probably within your skill set, is why we had a very high rate of problems solved and even higher rate of the topic being there. And other studies always get some significant dramatic problem-solving dreams in the course of incubating, but as the problem gets harder or as your motivation gets lower, it does drop lower than it did in that study.
Deirdre, has dream incubation helped you in any critical passages, helped you to make an important decision, put you at a turning point?
I have had some much subtler guidance from my dreams. Like when I was writing that book, there was one chapter where I was really stuck on whether I was going to organize it in a more narrative sort of way or kind of a factual research structure sort of way. And it sounds sort of silly once I had the dream, but I had these two very clearly different alternatives in my mind, and so I incubated a solution just phrased as which of these should I do, which is not really the way to approach it as I was so me. And so I had a dream where I was flying over a beautiful Caribbean type sea where I could see the clouds reflected on the surface about half of my view and down into this beautiful coral reef with fish at the same time. And it was like 50-50. I could see both things at the same time. And I woke up and it just kind of showed me this way to integrate the two approaches.
I can see how that would bring things together. It became very vivid, cinematically vivid, as you described it. We're talking to Deirdre Barrett at the moment about creative dream incubation. This is Where the Dream with Robert Mouse. We'll be back for more after the break.
Robert Moss has a collection of books, audio, video, and DVD products that will help you bring the creative and healing gift of dreams into your everyday life. Revitalize your work and relationships and journey to the furthest reaches of your imagination. These books are tools that everyone can use to begin or enhance active dreaming in their lives. Visit mossdreams.com. That's mossdreams.com. MOSSDREAMS.com.
Since ancient times, indigenous people from every culture have used their dreams to help interpret their lives, the world around them, and the future. Now you can tap into this indigenous wisdom with Robert Moss's workshops and classes, all designed to help you learn more about you and your connection to the dream world. If you are interested in finding out about how to host a class or workshop in your area, email Robert at robert@mossdreams.com. Or to find out about Robert's ongoing schedule of classes and workshops offered worldwide, visit his website, mossdreams.com. Get your personal dream symbols and discover the ones you dream about in Linda McKenzie's Symbols of You, a new book available at Amazon, Barnes & Noble, Target, and more.
You're listening to HealthyLife.net, the radio network that brings positive talk with positive change to make your world a little better.
You're listening to Way of the Dreamer with Robert Moss. We're talking with Deirdre Barrett about creative dream incubation. Deirdre, I want to share a couple of my book dreams that I asked for. I usually ask for dreams in the course of writing a book. When I was writing my first book on dreaming, conscious dreaming, which you know about because you wrote a generous endorsement for it, when I was working on that book, I set the intention to the night, show me how to bring the gifts of dreaming to more people. That was my intention. So, in the dream, which becomes lucid, I'm in something like a three-ring circus. And there's a preposterous fellow in a loud check suit, plaid suit, with a sort of pork pie hat and a big cigar. And he's doing ridiculous acrobatics. He's bouncing up to the top of the tent, and I know his name is Morty, said with a New York accent. Morty. He looks like a racetrack tout. And now lucid, I'm thinking, this is my guide. I'm asking for guidance on Morty, the racetrack tout, the fake acrobat. He bounces into the bleachers, grabs an attractive woman, smooches with her, puffs at his cigar, leers at me around the woman and the cigar smoke and says, it's about entertainment, kid. It's about entertainment. And I woke up laughing. I knew. But Morty, in his lack of evolution, was exactly the guide I needed at that moment. It's about entertainment. You've got to keep people turning the pages. So, of course, it supported my desire to tell stories. On the other hand, in a previous phase of my life, when I was a New York Times best-selling thriller writer, I had signed a contract to write another thriller with a Russian theme. I've written a popular one called Moscow Rules, now so out of print that someone else used the title. I don't want to do the book, but my life is tugging me in other directions. But, you know, like all middle-class white males, I'm a bit nervous about running out of money, so I think I've got to write a book for some money, which I used to make a lot of with books. So I'm trying to write a Russian thriller, but it's not going well. So I ask for guidance. And in this dream, I'm at a top-notch restaurant, and there's a banquet room set for hundreds of people. And the silverware is actually gold, and it's the most expensive porcelain, and I'm puffed up. Oh, this is all in my honor. But the maitre d' is trembling. I mean, he's shaking. I say, what's the matter with you? Mr. Moss, the problem is in the kitchen. What's the problem? The master chef is threatening to walk out. He says he will not cook any more stroganoff. If you insist on stroganoff, you will have to hire short-order cooks out in the street. Now, stroganoff is, of course, originally a Russian dish. I wake up, I get the message. I'm not laughing quite as heartily as when Morty said it's about entertainment, but I tear up the contract. I decided to cancel the book project, return the money, because I realized my creative self, my creative heart, my master chef would not be with me in that project. So those examples of, you know, big dreams giving an overall orientation. In one case, it thumbs down to something. The other case, it's, well, the thumbs up requires such and such. I will dream in the midst of writing a book on what I'm doing. I mean, for example, we mentioned earlier, I've been working on a chapter on Yeats or something, and I wondered whether, having written a lot about Yeats in the past and having to face the vast library of Yeatsiana, Yeats has been more written about than any author in English than Shakespeare. It's just colossal. Goes on every year. Looking at all the new material, all the scholarly articles, all the Yeats work itself, and thinking, well, should I really do this? And I dream with this on my mind, not with a fixed intention. I see an old-fashioned, beautifully engraved invitation to a wedding at Castle Island on Loch Key, which is where Yeats wanted to celebrate his Celtic mystical order. And the wedding is between Yeats, of course, and the woman he loved but could never have, Maud Gunn. And I received this invitation in my dream. Oh, I think I'm not done with that situation. It's not done with me. So, you know, there's magic in all of this, isn't it? But on an everyday basis, I don't set intentions, big intentions for dreams. I'll say, I'd like a new story.
I said, like an adventure, or I'll say if I'm leading a workshop or training, which I tend to be, even if it's mostly online these days, I'll say I'd like something for the group today, something for the day, just something like that, just sort of lightly open to new adventure, something along those lines. Yeah.
So. Yes, well, Yeats is a great example of someone who just spontaneously had a lot of dreams that he used in his work.
You know, you're
I think
absolutely
that,
right.
Yeah. The Jester in the right. Garden is one where he said he just, the poem is exactly as he dreamed it. But then just bits and pieces, phrases for one poem or, you know, a vision of a woman that became a character in another piece. His dreams seem to be supplying him rather steadily.
I'm so glad you said that because not enough has been actually written or recognized about this in the vast literature of Yeats. We've got lots about him as a poet and playwright, of course. We've got lots about him as a magus, magician of the Hermetic Order of the Golden Dawn, which he belonged to for decades. We've got lots about him in relation to the Celtic Renaissance. But the importance of dreams, including, as you're mentioning, spontaneous dreams, ones he didn't ask for, is something that has not been featured strongly enough. He said at one point in his life that the dreams that were granted to him, the dreams that were given to him, were more important than the ones that he sought. And when he talked about sought or seeking, he's talking about all the rituals, all the, you know, mumbo-jumbo, all the dress-up, ritual magic and so on that he and his inner circle practiced year after year after year, which produced certainly results. But he noted at a certain point that it was the ones that he hadn't asked for, the ones that he hadn't sought, that were perhaps the most important. Of course, he's also an example, although he wasn't as good at it as some of the women in his life. Florence Farr and Maud Gunn were probably better at these things than he was, but he tried hard. You know, the business of meeting people, rendezvousing in your dreams, mutual lucid dreaming, shared dreaming. So one's in Paris and one's in Dublin and one pops over to see the other and then waits because the other's engaged in a tea party or something. This, when you go through the letters and diaries, is the weave of his life. He's doing it all the time. So Yeats is a good person to refer to conjure when we think about what dreaming might be. And as you mentioned, of course, the poems themselves with their rhythm and rhyme carry us into a state of a kind of dreaming, don't they? I mean, the audio effect, the bardic effect is just extraordinary. And when you hear them read or read them yourself with Yeats's slow rolling style, you're off. I mean, they're expected to transport you into a dreamlike state. Yeah. I'm glad you share my love of Yeats. I didn't know that. That's very exciting.
Yes, well, I mean, I'm interested in anyone that uses dreams in their work. I mean, even like Stephen King has lots of stories about points where he was stuck on something and then he would dream the scene that he hadn't written yet. And I mean, I think he's a competent writer, but the sort of horror fiction is not particularly my favorite genre, but I'm still fascinated to read about his dream life, and it's interesting how it all kinds of writers, from the extremely literary to the very pop.
Stephen King has received an incredible reward for all the nightmares he's suffered to come. His bad dreams and nightmares have been the stuff of this best-selling horror fiction. And, of course, when you read The Stand, I actually read the full uncut version of The Stand. It's not only a dream-inspired book. Its account of dreaming, what goes on in dreaming, what is possible in dreaming, is so rich. All right, we'll probably keep on talking about writers and dreaming for a while when we come back. This is Robert Noss. We're talking with Deirdre Barrett about creative dreaming. Back after the break.
Robert Moss has a collection of books, audio, video, and DVD products that will help you bring the creative and healing gift of dreams into your everyday life. Revitalize your work and relationships and journey to the furthest reaches of your imagination. These books are tools that everyone can use to begin or enhance active dreaming in their lives. visit mossdreams.com. That's mossdreams.com. MOSSDREAMS.com.
Since ancient times, indigenous people from every culture have used their dreams to help interpret their lives, the world around them, and the future. Now you can tap into this indigenous wisdom with Robert Moss's workshops and classes, all designed to help you learn more about you and your connection to the dream world. If you're interested in finding out about how to host a class or workshop in your area, email Robert at robert@mossdreams.com. Or to find out about Robert's ongoing schedule of classes and workshops offered worldwide, visit his website, mossdreams.com.
HealthyLife.net, where positive overcomes negative.
You're listening to Way of the Dreamer with Robert Moss. I'm talking with the wonderful Deirdre Barrett about writers dreaming in particular in the last few minutes. And I'm going to lay another of my writer's stories on you, Deirdre, and it's somewhat personal between us because you actually know the literary agent involved, though I don't think I'll name him on the air right now. But it's about the publication of Conscious Dreaming. I told you a story about the style of Conscious Dreaming and the need to have entertainment. But I don't know whether you know the story I'm about to tell you. I've now done the book. And because I was a professional journalist and had published already, I mean, I had never written a book since I was 14 without a contract. I mean, I'd had the luxury of always having publishers pursuing me rather than the other way around. So when it comes to publishing a book in a new genre, a book on dreaming, my agent says, I've got a powerful agent, but he says, you better go away and finish this because people need to understand that this is the new you, and you haven't published much in this area, even though you've used it all your life. So I go off and I write the book that was published as Conscious Dreaming. He says, this is terrific. I have an editor for you. She turns out to be the right editor. He says, and here's the amount of money I'm going to ask for it. And I'm stunned. I mean, it's not a lot of money compared to what I earned writing best-selling thrillers, but I have no idea what you charge for a book on dreaming. I have absolutely no idea. He says, I'm your agent. Leave it to me. So he goes to the editor who loves the book, but is shocked by the amount of money that my agent wants. She says, you know, books on dreaming don't earn this kind of money. Even the top bestsellers don't earn anything like this. I'll offer you such and such. And he comes back and he says, well, this is what she's going to offer. I want to do an option because we can do better elsewhere. And now I am seriously disturbed. Butterflies in my stomach. I feel nauseous. I have no idea how to handle the transition. The monetary aspect of the transition. I'm out of my depth here. So I ask for a dream. And I know that he's ticked off the editor he's approached by saying we're going to have an auction. So here's the dream that I asked for. I asked for guidance on publishing my book, the book that is published as Conscious Dreaming. In my dream, I'm in my regular car and I need gas. And here's an Esso gas station. I say Esso because it's got a period quality. And I'm going to pull up at the pumps, but I can't stop. The car's engine is overcharging. I shoot past the pumps. I have to back up. It takes a while getting the nozzle in the tank, and the numbers go up slowly. But at the end of the day, I've got all the gasoline I need for the journey, and I take off in high spirits. And I wake up, and I start laughing, because I said, a Freudian's going to just have so much fun with this. A hard time getting the nozzle in the tank and numbers going up slowly, ha ha. However, we have different, you know, ways of dreaming. And in my dreams, gas stations were not about a regular situation. I've had many dreams involving the state of regular cars and road trips. In my dreams, gas stations are usually about energy and especially the energy of money. So I understand that the dream relates directly to my intention. And I write an executive summary. It's something like, we're overcharging, have to back up, use some finesse, the numbers won't look good, but all will be fine. So I call my agent and I tell her, back up, be nice to the editor, you've picked the right editor, things will be fine. He calls me back. She won't pay as much money as she offered to pay yesterday because she's pissed off because we talked about an auction. Make the deal, please. All will be fine. So reluctantly, he accepts my dream-inspired order as author to agent,
We make the deal, and Deirdre, 9 months later, I'm in San Francisco. My publicity schedule says I have a date to with a reporter, a columnist for the Contra Costa Times, whose shtick is he likes to take an interesting author to see a movie, and then that becomes part of the dinner or drinks conversation. The night before I arrive at the cinema, in another dream, I'm in a cold northern landscape where umbrellas going up and down all the time with a woman who resembles a young Catherine Deneuve who's coming on to me, and I'm charming, but I'm not interested. When I get to the cinema, the columnist tells me, we're not going to see I Killed Andy Warhol or whatever was on the schedule. He says, we're going to see the re-release of The Umbrellas of Cherbourg, starring Catherine Deneuve. So there we are. I've previewed the movie we're going to see at the Embarcadero Cinema, interesting in itself, perhaps. But here's the good part. Now I'm sitting in the cinema watching The Umbrellas of Cherbourg. It is a crazily Freudian film, perhaps one of the most Freudian films ever made. Everything is about sex. The umbrellas go up and down, it's about sex. Wine bottles are popped, it's about sex. There's a jangly, ridiculous sort of musical score. And then we come to the key scene. The hero, Guy, every man, his ambition in life is to own an Esso gas station. And when we come to the scene where Guy is realizing his life dream of the Esso gas station, I'm looking at the Esso gas station from my dream, the dream that led me to order my agent to make the deal that brought me to the cinema 9 months later. So I've noticed in my life that there is sometimes a seam, if you live long enough, I guess, there's sometimes an incredible interweave between dream synchronicity and life. And I've also noticed, as this example, you know, dramatizes, that the practical applications of this stuff are tremendous. Of course, the frustration for sober researchers, sometimes including yourself and your colleagues you've mentioned, is that the really interesting wildlife doesn't agree to be in the laboratories or viewable, you know, within the cages of, you know, a calibrated inspection. So that's one of my favorite stories about where incubation can take you in terms of getting a book where it needs to be.
Oh, yeah, that's a lovely example.
So what else do you have to say to us about creativity, dreaming, practical applications of all this stuff?
I was thinking when you asked me if I had an example of an incubated problem-solving dream, and I did, but a very sort of mild one compared to the dramatic, you know, I have a Harvard colleague who designs radio telescopes in his dream that a huge lab then constructs exactly as he's seen it in his dreams. You know, things like Kekulé, just things that are both more major breakthroughs, but also that are much more specific and not metaphoric. And I was kind of, I've often reflected on why my own examples are not as dramatic as many people's. And I think that for me, part of it is because I do other related imagery things, like hypnosis is my kind of secondary area. And so I do a lot of trance work where I go into a trance and I anywhere from ask another friend I think of as wise on this topic or just try to connect with my inner unconscious self and ask it a question. And very, very reliably, the sort of hypnotic trance thing will give me an answer and a little bit more explicitly than my dreams. But I think in other ways, that's true for some people, but not all people. Like a lot of the native tribes use the same word dream, that waking imagery. And some of the most dramatic dreamers I talked to would start telling me dream examples, that they would be saying it was a dream, and then they would say they were walking through this landscape, like physically, and began to dream about X, and I was, wait a minute, you were walking when you had this dream? And they use it for waking vision. So I assume it's maybe true of you, because I know you do shamanic journeying and all, that For some people, the same stuff comes awake, and for others, it's really only in your dreams that you see this kind of dramatic unconscious representation.
Right. Yeah, the indigenous people that I know best walk in the world as if the world is a waking dream. I mean, everything is alive to them. And we apply Jung's term synchronicity. They don't necessarily use that word. They just recognize that everything is alive. Everything is speaking. The Aborigines talk about the speaking land. And then to demonstrate that something happened in a dream rather than on your 2 feet walking a certain landscape, the Kukajar will tap 2 fingers against the left wrist to show that this was actually a sleep experience. But that's about the only distinction that is made. All right, we've been talking to Deirdre Barrow, a wonderful conversation about creative dreaming. We'll be back in a moment to say dream on.
Since ancient times, indigenous people from every culture have used their dreams to help interpret their lives, the world around them, and the future. Now you can tap into this indigenous wisdom with Robert Moss's workshops and classes, all designed to help you learn more about you and your connection to the dream world. If you are interested in finding out about how to host a class or workshop in your area, email Robert at robert@mossdreams.com. Or to find out about Robert's ongoing schedule of classes and workshops offered worldwide, visit his website, mossdreams.com.
Robert Moss has a collection of books, audio, video, and DVD products that will help you bring the creative and healing gift of dreams into your everyday life. Revitalize your work and relationships and journey to the furthest reaches of your imagination. These books are tools that everyone can use to begin or enhance active dreaming in their lives. Visit mossdreams.com. That's mossdreams.com. MOSSDREAMS.com.
HealthyLife.net, where positive overcomes negative.
Deirdre, thank you so much for sharing your arts of dreaming with us. You're an artist too, by the way, a dream-inspired artist. And may your best dreams come true.
Yes, if people want to know more about me, my website, which is DeirdreBarrett.com, has my art, my books, anything I've been talking about, there's more on the website.
Thank you for that. We'll put that up at my website when we update the archive. Thanks so much for dreaming with us, Deirdre, and to everybody listening, may your best dreams come true, and may you remember them.